I wish to welcome you here to Amaravati this afternoon. This is the first talk in this series. Again, I repeat that the purpose of these talks is to try to create an atmosphere of reflection, contemplation, so that what I say is to be regarded only as a means towards your own reflection on the spiritual development or religion or the subjects that we talk about. The Buddhist teachings are reflective teachings, so that's why we can say it's not a doctrinal approach. Buddhist teachings are for consideration and for investigation, to apply those teachings to your own experience, to internalize them, so you begin to realize those truths, truths that the Buddha was talking about, rather than just believing in words or ideas from somebody else. Because the truth is something that we need to know in a direct way. The problems that we face in our lives so much evolve from just accepting someone else's ideas and then acting on just reactions to those ideas, in which we never really penetrate profoundly into the true nature of things. This afternoon I was talking about what we call inner listening. And this is a skillful means that we use in order to, say, look at something in a different way. We tend to regard listening as listening outwardly, trying to listen to somebody else or sounds that come from the outside, listening to music or sound of another person or whatever. But inner listening, we direct our attention as if we were listening inwardly to, say, the thoughts, feelings that we are experiencing. The human mind is a reflective mind. It means that in this life that we have, being born in the human form, it means that we can contemplate and look at our own bodies, our emotions, feelings, thoughts. All the mental formations can be objectified. That's what we mean by reflective mind. If our mind were merely a conditioned mind, if we had no ability to reflect on it, then we would merely operate according to what's been programmed or put into the mind through our experience of life, and we would have no possible way of transcending it or getting beyond it. An animal's mind, the difference between an animal and a human being, very much one of the differences anyway, is the fact that they don't have reflective minds. Their minds they are certainly conscious in the same way we are. They have intelligence, certain level of instinctual intelligence, but they cannot reflect on their own nature. A squirrel can't contemplate squirrelness. But we can contemplate our own humanity. We can ask ourselves, what is a human being? What is it that makes me human and not a squirrel? What is the difference between a mind that just operates on the instinctual plane and a reflective mind? So these are the types of questions that we can ask ourselves. The human body itself, if if we are just the human form that we have, if that's what our true nature is, then the body itself cannot contemplate itself. For example, your eyes can't look and see themselves, and the body, its very nature is such that it is what it is, but it can't realize itself. But the reflective mind can contemplate and realize the nature of the body, the human body. Inner listening then is a skillful means we use just to say bring attention to our ability to listen. And in listening we have to be mindful, don't we? We have to pay attention. If I'm really listening to you, I have to stop thinking and just drifting away in my own moods or feelings of the moment to try to pay attention to what you're saying. I'm listening to, say, if you're telling me something very important, then I have to really pay attention and listen, try to understand what you are saying to me. Well, that same attitude, apply it inwardly, just to say your own sense of grief or despair or depression or anger or fear. As if you're really attentively listening to it rather than judging it. If we merely judge the condition, then we have no way of really hearing its message. For example, if you're trying to tell me something, and so what you're trying to tell me, I merely make a judgment about it, a superficial judgment, that means I can't really understand or hear what you're saying. I merely react to it. My reaction might be totally inappropriate to what you're trying to tell me. And apply that inwardly to yourself. If you feel frightened or you feel angry or jealous or some unpleasant negative state, you happen to be in that kind of a mood, and you merely pass a judgment on it as some criticism of that state, that means you can't really, you're not really sensitive to it. You're merely trying to dismiss it, reject it. So inner listening means a patient attentiveness to the mood you're in, to the kind of thoughts or attitudes that you happen to be experiencing at this moment. Attentive attention and willingness to listen, even to very unpleasant things or ugly things, means that we're patient. We need to be very, very patient and just have an attitude of acceptance of whatever it is, no matter how unpleasant or unwanted the particular quality of what you're listening to might be. You're just watching it, noticing it, accepting it, and reflecting that it is merely an object of your mind. Because that which pays attention is not a negative state, isn't it? The attentive mind, the mind that is listening, that which listens, that which is aware, is cannot be negative. It can be aware of negativity, anger or greed or doubt or worry. But in itself, it has no quality that we could describe as negative. The attentive, aware, mindful state of being in the present. And in this way, we can look at, say, fear or anger, unwanted negativity, mental states, and clearly see it as an object. Now this is important because it's important to realize that an object then can no longer be seen as oneself, isn't it? When we objectify something, we know this. I know this clock is not me because it's very separate. It's not the subject. It's the object of my vision. I might add to it saying, this is my clock. It's not really my clock, but I might think that. I make it mine, but one never mistakes it for being oneself. And the same would apply to any mood you happen to be in. If once you determine in your mind to listen and pay attention to the mood, then you've destroyed the subjective identification with the mood. The mood is what it is. The thought is what it is. But it's no longer, its identity as the subject has been destroyed because you are reflecting on it as an object. And so this is what we could say is the Buddha. The Buddha means that ability of a human being to reflect on the way things are. The Buddha is that which knows and sees clearly, is not deluded by the appearance of any condition whatsoever. So when we take refuge in Buddha, the attitude of a Buddhist is one of refuge, this means that we are determining to be attentive, aware to the way things are, the mood, the condition, the atmosphere, the feeling, the thought, the quality, and observing its nature for what it is, that whatever its quality, whatever its appearance might be, the truth of the matter is that it is something that is impermanent. When you objectify something, then you see it as impermanent. It arises and ceases. When you contemplate impermanence, then you break down the illusion of that particular condition being a kind of permanent problem for you. Like on the personality level, we tend to identify very strongly with the memories we have of our past. So if we tend towards anger or fear or jealousy, then we tend to think that this is a kind of ongoing, permanent problem with us. This is the way we would talk about it, is that I happen to be a very frightened person, or I'm a very jealous kind of person. As if this was an ongoing, latent condition that hangs in one's mind. But when seen or objectified by listening to the anger or the jealousy, you're taking away the identity. You're no longer judging it as or placing yourself in as the one that owns that state. You're merely observing it as impermanent. It is what it is. You're not trying to say it's something it isn't. You're not adding anything to it, you're not making it into something else. You're not even trying. You're even avoiding trying to get rid of it or to prolong it. You're merely accepting, noticing, listening to it. And when it's present, then you're aware it is this way. And as you keep your attention with that, when it's gone, because it is impermanent, there's the knowing that it's not there. There's the awareness of its presence. It's this way. Say, for example, anger. It's this way. Anger is this way. In this way of reflecting it, this way is merely a way of acknowledging it without judging it. then when it's not present, you reflect on it that there's no anger now. That it's this way, the mind is this way. It's the condition of anger is no longer present. So in your conscious experience of life, you are acknowledging the way things are, the presence of a condition such as anger and the absence of it. And in that way, you're bringing into consciousness the way things are as a continuum rather than merely being conscious through extremity. Now this is another reflection, is that since we are conscious beings, our consciousness tends to depend very much on extremity of condition. Like we want to titillate or bring into our we're usually conscious through some kind of extreme experience. We tend to not be very conscious, use consciousness and as a continuous, through continuous awareness. Consciousness is we use through distracting ourselves or through seeking something that excites, interests, fascinates, or in some way holds our attention. And then when we lose our interest, when it becomes boring or unpleasant, we tend to seek to put something else into consciousness, so that we tend to live a life of say running around trying to say have interesting experiences or pleasant sensory experiences. Or when we get tired of all that, we try to be unconscious just through say falling asleep, drugging ourselves, making it so that we don't have to feel or have any real conscious experience. But with inner listening, you're allowing, you're training, you're practicing in a way that consciousness is being used with wisdom rather than with ignorance. Now even the most ignorant, stupid, insane, ridiculous human being is still a conscious one. And that sometimes we have to make them unconscious if they're really violent. We try to drag them up so they aren't conscious because they're dangerous. But madness and total delusion, it doesn't make us unconscious. Consciousness is the result of birth. We're born because we are born into the into a separate form, such as the human body. Then this is the experience of living a lifetime as a conscious being. We experience consciousness from this place that we have to be in, this human body, and consciousness implies this sense of separation, subject and object. So one, say, has to be the subject of one's conscious experience for a lifetime within the body and that we are born into from the time we're born to the time it dies. And this is what consciousness is about. And during that time that we live, the lifespan of our human body, then it is going to experience all kinds of things. Good, bad, happiness, suffering, praise and blame, success and failure, good fortune, bad fortune. There's a human lifetime is a mixture of all kinds of extremes. We're born into a particular family. And usually our families are not enlightened families. Our mothers and fathers are not arahants, usually. And I've not met anyone yet who's made that claim. And We, even though our mothers and fathers certainly may have a measure of wisdom and goodness, yet generally, from our own particular cultural background, they teach us the things that our class, our race, our nationality, our ethnic background consider right and normal for us. So, for example, I was born into a Christian middle-class family in the United States. And so my parents, with all good intention, instilled in me all the values and ideals of that particular class and group. Some of it's very good. Some of it had certain good aspects to it and noble qualities. But it was very much based on the assumption of a permanent personality, that you are this way and you should be this way, you should think like this, you shouldn't be like that, and that all the Christian attitudes, of high church Anglicanism were instilled in my mind at a tender age, and the attitudes of white middle class Americans of the 30s and 40s were 1930s and 1940s were very much my preliminary experience with life, those kind of values. So those were instilled in my mind just through being born into that family, and those values just came with the package, in other words. They weren't my parents certainly had good intentions and were trying to do the best they can, but the whole attitude still was based on the illusion of you are this body, you are a person, you are your feelings, your thoughts, you are this type of personality. Also with the idea that you should be maybe you should try to become something else, like become what the society, what my parents and the society thought was the ideal for male children to become. So these were just accepted as the ordinary, normal standards for life. Then as I grew older, even though I was given quite good standards to work with, this whole basic illusion of me and mine, myself, my personality, I am this body, and the I shoulds and the I shouldn'ts, began to work a kind of miserable mental state into my experience of life. Because one became very self-conscious, and in a competitive society like middle-class America, your worth is very much in relationship to somebody else. What other boys do, and how strong or clever or fast or whatever they are, you compare yourself with them as if you are permanently better or worse or equal to somebody else. One is not even encouraged to question this tendency. This tends to be a kind of dread and fear that's ingrained in us. The fear that we're not good enough, or the assumptions that we can't do things because somebody else does them better. Or that oftentimes in school, in education, we're convinced we can't do certain things because teachers have, or other peers have implied that you're no good at this or you can't do that. So these things we hold on to and grasp, and they influence and affect our life in many, many ways. Such as we find ourselves oftentimes with unknown anxieties and coming from assumptions that were probably instilled in us when we were still very innocent, before we had any, knowledge or understanding of anything. when, say, an innocent mind is a mind that will receive anything. It can, you can instill the best to the worst possible conditions in an innocent child, because they haven't yet the ability to discriminate what is true or what isn't. They tend to believe very much what the parents or the authority figures tend to tell them. So we can spend a lifetime very much holding on to an inadequate assumption of ourself that will affect, say, our lives and blind us and cause us much unhappiness and misery, until we begin to reflect on it and contemplate. And then inner listening is a way of doing this. We can begin to just listen to maybe these irrational fears or these obsessions of the mind, not as a kind of personal fault anymore, because as soon as you make out that they're bad or you shouldn't have them, then that's a negative, that's a criticism against them, as if they shouldn't be there, and that there's something wrong with you for having that kind of thought or obsession. So inner listening is non-judgmental, it's attentive, and it's coming from the place of transcendent awareness rather than absorption. Absorption is the ability to grasp something and become like that. But inner listening then isn't absorbing into the condition, it's merely observing it, witnessing, recognizing it for what it is. Now, there was one monk, I remember, who was a monk that all of us thought very highly of, and he was, the lay people thought very highly of him, and he had great talents and abilities. He was somebody that people generally took to very easily and praised, and yet this particular monk would always have this assumption, this kind of ongoing fear that he was worthless. So no matter how successful this monk might have been in anything he did, there would be this underlying kind of obsession going on saying, you're no good, you can't do anything right. And this wasn't a rational thing at all, because I mean, he could see very well that he was doing well, and that everything was going along, and he was quite talented and could do all these things. He was certainly aware that this was all right. But this was something irrational, something instilled that had become so kind of obsessive and a part of his life that it was hard to really get any perspective on it. The tendency was to just dismiss it and say, oh, of course, don't be so silly. I'm just trying to dismiss it as a silly thing you shouldn't be thinking. Or needing constant affirmation from others. Did I do it all right? Is it okay? You're sure now? You're sure that what I said and what I'm doing is okay? So the need to have other people affirm or to dismiss. So inner listening to this obsession, allowed him to, say, just accept that kind of obsession for what it is in the present moment, when it was in operation. There is attentiveness, listening, non-judgment. It was seen, it was something that was impermanent. You can comment on its impermanency, because it is. It has no kind of solid, substantial quality at all. And by accepting and listening and paying attention to it as an impermanent condition, as an impermanent object in the mind, that more and more he became aware of it as not self, as merely something that went on, that would come and go, but was no longer an accurate judgment, or any, it had no real truth to it at all. It was merely a soulless, empty habit that he'd acquired in some way. It had no soul or self or essence in it. It was merely a conditioned thing. It could be a nonsense syllable, or it could be sensible, but it was merely just a something that was conditioned, had no power anymore. But when you would react to it through either indulging, believing in it, or in just trying to reject it and dismiss it, then it did seem to have a reality to it. It you could say, well, this inner voice is saying I'm no good, and it's probably true. Maybe I'm no good. Maybe, you know, this is probably some kind of truth that a true description of me, that I'm no good. And the doubting mind will get caught up into fearing that this might be a real true statement of one's worth. When objectified and listened to for what it is, it really becomes a meaningless, empty thing in your mind. So this, by listening to this obsession, to listen to it, there had to be an acceptance of it. Because if you're resisting it, you can't listen to it anymore. You're merely reacting to it. And by accepting and watching, it loses its power to delude. It's just a thing, another thing that arises and ceases. It's no longer important or true or a cause of doubt or anything. It's just a thing in the mind. It is what it is. But the illusion of it being me has been dissolved, disappeared. Now when that disappears, when it's gone, there's also the ability to recognize the non-presence of it. Because it's very important to realize when there's nothing in the mind, when there's no condition or no attachment in the mind. So this is in the teaching of the Buddha, the second and third noble truths, dealing with the reflection and investigation of those two truths, it's to realize, to know, and to let go of a condition so that you can see it and objectify it, and to realize its cessation when it's not present. So then your consciousness is being trained and taught through wisdom. So this experience of being a conscious being, a human being, allows us to use wisdom with our consciousness. Our consciousness is no longer just affected by circumstances, and we're just helpless victims of a conditioning process, because we can't very well help the way we've been conditioned. A lot of it, can we? We're born into some family, and circumstances are like this. We don't have the ability to choose. I want to be born into a family of arahants. At least I don't remember ever having that choice. Some people say we choose our parents, and I wouldn't doubt that. It seems possible, but I don't remember any kind of intentionally choosing my parents. My parents did have their ways and their attitudes, and my society and experience of life was the way it is, which, on just the condition plane, left me at a point, say at the age of 30, feeling quite depressed and despairing with life. because on the level of my conditioned mind, I was feeling quite unhappy and had tremendous feeling of anguish and despair by the age of 30, just from operating through reacting to life through the conditions that I'd acquired. I couldn't see at the age of 30 any possibility of just going on living in the same way and having any happiness at all. I thought, you know, even if I live 30 more years, you know, when you're 30, 60 seems quite a lot like an elderly, quite an old age, but even 30 more years of living in this state of despair seemed unbearable. You know, even suicide seemed to be a more attractive alternative than 30 more years in this kind of continuous negative state, or seemingly an attitude, a negative attitude that tended to be highly affecting my mind much of the time. And because of that suffering, that recognition of the first noble truth of dukkha, this what led me into this life as a monk. Because there is at least I saw the possibility that possibly by doing something, by developing what I thought would be Buddhist meditation, there was a possibility of changing the direction so that the rest of my life wouldn't be just a helpless victim of what had happened to me during the first 30 years. That would be a really miserable state of affairs, wouldn't it? If all we could expect was to just kind of grin and bear it for the rest of our lives with the botch we've made of our lives for the first 30 years. So, the aim of Buddhist teaching then is to train the mind, to train our consciousness with wisdom, and the teachings then of the Buddha are wisdom teachings. It's not wisdom per se. Wisdom is something we use, something here and now. It's not a teaching in a book. You can't say a teaching is in itself wise. It has wisdom kind of laying there in a book, and you read it, and the wisdom suddenly jumps into your mind. The words, say the wise words in a book, are merely a catalyst for wisdom. They help you to, if you're using it rightly, if you are contemplating the meaning of those words and interiorizing it, applying it to your own experience, to your mind and body, then you begin to understand. You have what we call insight, profound insight into Dhamma, into the truth, ultimate truth. So instead of being a helpless victim of circumstances, we change that direction. We're no longer a victim, we are the leader, we are the charioteer, we're in the driver's seat. We are beginning to take that position of attention, awareness, wisdom, reflection, rather than just kind of putting up with things, a kind of grin and bear it, poor me attitude. For the rest of our life, we can actually begin to live our life in full awareness with wisdom when we realize this possibility that we all have. What is so really beautiful about the Buddhist teaching is that Buddhism does have a kind of ancient history. It's not a modern Californian therapy. It hasn't been discovered by Carl Jung or a Swiss psychologist. It seems, in our terms of antiquity, it's quite ancient, going back 2,533 years to someone my age. That seems like a very ancient kind of teaching. And yet it obviously is a universal teaching, a teaching based on ultimate truth, because it still is true at this time. It's in its pure form. The Buddhist teaching can be used. It still works. It takes us to that realization. If it were merely a kind of religion appropriate to the age, say, of ancient India, then it wouldn't have much meaning to us at this time. There might be a few kind of ancient Indian enthusiasts who might find it terribly fascinating to research and go to the museums and write boring books about ancient Indian religion that very few people would find very inspiring. But because it's a teaching based on truth that is timeless, not bound by culture or by fashion, then we find ourselves here in a place like Amaravati, or we seek out Buddhist teachers, or any Buddhism has that resonance in our minds, isn't it, of a possibility of realizing ultimate reality or truth, or getting beyond just the limitations of our conditioning, the feeling of helplessness and hopelessness and despair that come from just being bound into inadequate attitudes and thoughts and perceptions of ourselves and the world. That there is a way out of that, that we don't have to be like that. In practicing Dhamma or meditation, we develop skillful means, and inner listening is one that I've found very useful for my own practice. I used to spend a lot of time just listening to my mind. I remember when I went to stay at the monastery in Thailand, I tended to have a kind of grumbling nature. So when I went, it was in the northeastern part of Thailand, quite primitive, there weren't many amenities there, kind of basic allowances given, and the food wasn't all that delicious, and there was a lot that, say, a middle-class American could complain about when you're used to, say, a higher standard and more comfort than what was available there. So that the mind would tend to complain a lot. I remember one of the things we had to do was when we went out on the alms round in the morning. It was a very hot climate, Thailand. The idea was that we had to wear all our robes when we went out on the alms round. So we have this robe here, and then we have a double robe called a sangati. And in our tradition, we had to wear this sangati, which is double thickness, with this robe. You had to put it on, and sometimes it would be so hot, by the time you came back from your alms round, you would have perspired, and it would have completely, your robes, both robes would be soaked with perspiration. It was very uncomfortable sometimes to be out with two robes on and having to walk long distances and come back and be all sweaty and miserable. And I thought, this is pointless. This is... I just don't believe the Buddha ever taught this. And so I'd be grumbling away. I'd do it because they said you had to do it. And my mind would always, when I was putting on this robe and you were sweating and felt terrible, and I would increase the misery by this continuous complaining. So it would be so much more practical. You don't need two robes. I mean, one robe is enough to cover you modestly or not. You know, it's adequate. And surely the Buddha was teaching the middle way. He wasn't an extremist of any sort. I think these monks here, Ajahn Chah, had probably gone to off on an extreme. I wish he would listen to me. I would advise him. I never had the courage to advise him on this matter. But the grumbling would go on. And then one day I began to listen to this. And I just began to listen to myself grumbling. And I heard was pretty unpleasant. But before I was just grumbling as a habit, and I wasn't aware of how miserable I was making myself because I had become used to being miserable like that. It was ordinary for me to be miserable in that way. As I complain, it's easy for me to complain and grumble. But then by listening to this grumbling sound, I could suddenly realize it is a very unpleasant condition of my mind. It was really painful and unpleasant. Just that to have that kind of negative feeling that would be with you while you're sweating and walking and going through these villages receiving alms food, and it would kind of hang around, you know, it would be influencing everything, so that the whole beautiful experience that I was going through, going on an alms round, receiving alms food and all this, was not really being appreciated because there was this level of filmy, cloudy, murky negativity that prevented me from really appreciating what was actually happening. So I'd, instead of just trying to not grumble, because by taking it very personally, I shouldn't be grumble. I shouldn't be a grumbler. I should be someone who's very happy, kind of going on this alms round, receiving this food in this very noble way, and then condemning this grumbling state. That was also not the way to solve the problem. But by actually listening to it, accepting it, then suddenly it became almost like without any substance or any force to it. It just what it was what it was. It was that way. But something was no longer there. And that was the grasping of it. It just the grasping had gone, and there was the realization of non-grasping. So then, I contemplated. I thought, well, actually, two robes is two robes, one robe, whatever they say, it's perfectly all right. I'll do what is the custom. There's no point in making a problem about these things because they're not problems. If it was something wrong and harmful to your health and dangerous and going to cause misfortune to other people, then maybe you should try to inform the masters about this. But actually there is nothing harmful, wrong in any way about wearing both your robes on the alms round. And then over the years I began to even appreciate it. To where I began to feel I went to a monastery 6 years later in central Thailand where they didn't wear both robes. They said, we believe that the Buddha didn't really mean you had to wear both robes, but you had to keep, when you were out on the alms round, you should keep one robe in a safe place. So you should lock your little kuti so that no thieves will come in and steal your double robe. And so then, I remember when they told me this, I began to think, they don't wear both their robes. They're at our monastery, we wouldn't get away with that. We have to wear both our robes, which is, by this time I'd been thoroughly converted to the and began kind of criticizing monasteries that didn't do exactly the same way. But this is so another problem. I make another problem about that. But the thing, what became apparent was that these are conventions only that one can we use, and that they shouldn't be really made into any problem, because ultimately it doesn't matter where you were. One robe or two robes, it's not really an absolute moral position that one should take on these issues, but it is a matter of reflection, isn't it? One can learn from both monasteries, because your mind, once you get used to both robes, then if you go to the next monastery where they use one, you can have the same problem, only kind of reversed. So the important thing was really in being aware of the tendency of the mind, the way of grasping, taking a position for or against. Here at Amravati, we've in the past 6 years, the emphasis on this inner listening. The level of complaining of the monks and nuns has diminished enormously. Because I've made a point and encouraged them to really listen to their complaining minds. And they do, you know. Once you start listening to it, you don't, you know, it's not something that you're going to believe prolong that tendency in your life. As samanas, as monks, as nuns, we have very skillful conventions to work with, such as we do have, like simple reflections on requisites, so that you're not expecting, say, the best in this life. Your aim in the monastic life is not to get the very best of everything. So your standard is based on usually the worst, such as the robe as a rag robe. So then the mind, you put that into consciousness. The Buddha allowed monks, bhikkhus, to collect rags to make a robe. We can go around and find rags and we can make a robe. And then he allowed lay people to offer material to the monks, so that lay people can offer cloth to the monks. We can accept that. But the standard, the basic reflection, is based on the scavenging rags. You see? So then this gives us a reflection on that the robe I have is very nice textile given to me by considerate lay people. So I don't have to go around scrounging for rags at Oxfam, but a very nice robe actually, but the sense of it, of being grateful, isn't it, rather than complaining. Like, say, if I had high expectations, or I had certain very high standards for textiles, and you didn't give me what I wanted that wasn't to the standard that I was expecting, I would grumble and complain about it. So in this way, we can listen to that level of our own kind of hopes and expectations of life, through reflecting on the standards given to us in the monastic life. So, I mean, when you listen to your mind, if you get a robe that you don't particularly like, maybe it's not the kind of material you wanted or you would prefer, but your reflection is based on the fact that the Buddha allowed us to get rags, and that this is certainly better than a rag, it's certainly finer quality than that. Then there's a sense of gratitude, and that sense of gratitude is a virtue, a beautiful virtue in the human heart that helps towards enlightenment, towards understanding. So gratitude, rather than complaining, gratitude is the joy of our hearts when we feel grateful and we have this experience of gatanyu. The mind, the heart is opened wide. It's a happy, joyful mind in gratitude, where the complaining mind is closed and short-sighted and painful. Inner listening then is, I like to describe it as, for example, you're listening to somebody talking on the other side of the fence. You're just standing there listening. And what they're saying is no longer anything about you. They can be talking about somebody else or the weather or just nonsense. It's all right. It doesn't matter what they're saying. It's just you're aware of it as being an object. Where as soon as you make the assumption of a self, then you become critical of it, you buy into it, you absorb into it, and you either believe it or you're trying to dismiss it or reject it. So there's always these reactions, judgmental reactions, that prolong and create a karmic attachment to it, like suppression. The desire to annihilate and get rid of things is a very powerful karmic attachment. Like the more you try to get rid of your anger, the more angry you become. You know, with anger, the more you try to deny it, get rid of it, push it away, the more angry you actually become. Become obsessed with anger by trying to get rid of it. But by recognizing it and accepting it, seeing it, knowing when it's present and when it's not, then you're not making any karma with that condition anymore. You've not created anything around it. It's merely the recognition, the knowing, the awareness of it for what it is. It's when it's present and when it's not. And in that there's no karma being made. It's you've allowed that condition which has arisen to cease. That's its nature, that's Dhamma. Whatever arises ceases. And you've not in any way been deluded by that condition. But there is certainly the intelligent wisdom, awareness and knowledge of it for what it is. So it doesn't mean that we'll never feel anger again, that just that alone will completely wipe out anger for the rest of our life. It doesn't mean that, but it means that we are aware at least of what anger is, so every time we tend to feel that impulse, we have an opportunity to let it go or to allow it to cease according to its nature, natural way. And therefore we're no longer frightened by it, no longer making a problem or any complications around these impulses or these conditions that we find ourselves with. There is the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. There is the way of recognizing things as they are. And this is what we mean as our heritage as Buddhists or as people who have a confidence and trust in the way of the Buddha, the convention of Buddhism allows us to use these and to liberate the mind from these onerous burdens of selfishness and despair. So it's time to end the formal talk, and I think we take a short break, 5-minute break.